My name is Diego, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Diego.
This is an open meeting of the Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others, alcoholics, to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to may recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our tradition reminds us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA Safety Card and Safety AA, our common welfare. Sorry. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I scratched off the name of who will read the steps. Sorry.
Emily. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Thank you. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. All of our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all of our speakers to identify by first name only and to refrain from using profanity. Our first 10-minute speaker is Ian.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Hi to the folks on Zoom. I'm so grateful to be here. And Sarah, thank you so much for the ask. One of the first things that I learned in AA was when asked, if I'm able, I say yes, and I show up for life. A little bit about me. I didn't start drinking until I was in college. I was a good girl, and I thought I figured if I waited till college and did all the right things, I would be okay. I grew up in a household of good good morals and values, and drugs and alcohol did not enter the home at all. So I knew nothing of the world of drugs and alcohol. But my home culture was about more, you know. I don't know if it was nature or nurture or whatever that led me to be an alcoholic, but when I was younger, it was more school, more sports, more Girl Scout cookies. I gotta tell you, I could sell some Girl Scout cookies. Anyways, like the disease of more. So enter college, I get there, and I find alcohol. You know, I join a sorority, I'm there on scholarship, and I'm playing field hockey, and I start to lose things right away. I put alcohol in my body, and all bets were off. I became a binge drinker overnight, and I started to lose things. I started to have problems with that scholarship. I started to have problems with the field hockey team. And then when you start to have problems with your sorority, and they ask you to maybe reconsider your drinking, you know, that's a problem. So I took my first geographical, and sorority to be unnamed. But anyway, I took my first geographical. I didn't know that was what it was at the time, but I went to London. I thought if I put an ocean between myself and my problems, because I was already starting to have relationship problems, problems with school and teachers and all that kind of stuff, and you know, I would just disappear, and it was awful. So I put an ocean between myself and my problems, and as it turns out, in London, they do have alcohol there, too. Sometimes I have this built-in forgetter, and I forget things. And when I arrived in London, I was already, I was so hungover, I had misplaced my luggage. I had mislabeled it at the airport. So by the time I get to London, I have no luggage. So my bright idea was to get a job right away. Where do you think I got a job? At the pub right across the street. I thought it was a wonderful idea. So I start working, and you know, I start drinking. And of course, as we all know, you bring your problems with you. So the problem started there again and again and again. And I would get myself into scrapes, and I thought they were funny stories. You know, when those funny stories when you're 20 aren't so funny when you're 30 and when you're 40. So everyone knew there was a problem. And, you know, but I just didn't know how to solve the problem. Somehow, I don't know how, but I managed to, you know, get through grad school, and I went to a university that had a career track, so I got a job right away in New York on Wall Street right before 9/11. So I come into this big job, and I had this big ego and this big thirst, this big appetite for more, and I thought I had arrived, you know, and the ego was just, unrelenting. And I would just drink, you know, work hard, play hard. And not to date myself, but it was at a time when women, had to, weren't on exactly even playing field with men. So I thought I had to show up and I had to drink with the boys. And those might sound like outdated expressions, but that's what I was doing, you know. And work hard, play hard. And I got to tell you, the amount of money that I spent on alcohol and rent and shoes in New York City was just obscene. It was just obscene. And I would get myself into scrapes. I would, you know, get a bill that I had no idea from St. Elizabeth's Hospital. I don't remember that. You know, this would happen again and again and again. Every year I would check my credit to see what bills to hospitals I had because I didn't remember where I was. But of course I could never check myself into a rehab because that would mean I was an alcoholic. But I knew there was a problem. I would go to a meeting like this and I would hear stories from a speaker. They didn't look like me, they didn't sound like me, they were older than me, they had these problems that I had never heard of, you know, problems with their marriage or their kids or their job or the police. Oh my gosh, you know, like these kind of things, they weren't part of my story, so I thought I was different, you know, this perpetual uniqueness. And, you know, as it turns out, I'm not different than anybody else, but I would hear just enough to get me out the door. You know, I grew up in a household that was spiritual, and I thought I knew God, and I would, you know, read the steps, and I'm like, you know, I got it. You know, check 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I actually grew up in an academic household, so my first big book has red marks in it. I really had the audacity. I had the gall to try to find grammar errors in the big book. So that just shows you where my head was. It was that contempt prior to investigation. And I thought I knew better. I thought I was different. I thought I could figure it out. You know, if I would just try a new plan, if I would just try a new diet. I think one year I tried going to communion like it was my job. I worked around the corner from St. Patrick's Cathedral, and they have communion on the hour. Like, if I can eat enough communion, you know, like, I'm going to cure my drinking problems. You know, I would try anything and everything, and it just didn't get any better. So, thank you. And I would just lose things. And I would lose a trail of things, keys, phones, you know. And, you know, the things added up. And, of course, if I actually think about the financial things I lost, it's painful. But the real things that I lost were my hopes, my goals, my aspirations, my self-respect, my dignity. I mean, I would wake up you know, in places where I just shouldn't be. You know, waking up naked on your front yard is not a cool place to be, you know? Like, this is just not normal behavior. I travel a lot for work, and me, planes, trains, and automobiles, it's just not normal to get kicked off a plane. You know, these are just not normal behavior. And I thought it was a funny story, yeah. You know, so I would be able to put a year together, a year and a half together once, and my last relapse was in 2015. I thought I got it, you know? I had gotten this big assignment in Dubai, and it's a dry country. I was in Qatar and Kuwait City, and you know, I had all these plans, you know, like, I'm not going to drink, it's wonderful, I was engaged, I had all the stuff and the things, I just bought a house, and I thought I had arrived. I neglected to think about the 18 hours on the flight in business class at Emirates, when my ego was just feeding this. You know, one glass of wine won't kill me, you know, and now the 18 hours, I destroyed 18 months of sobriety. So that led to, as we know, it's a progressive disease, so it took me 4 years to get back. My last drink was in February 2020, and it took me a really long time to get there. And I had to do all the stuff, all the things. I had to have all the drinks and learn all the lessons. And I think we're all on our own recovery journey, and I'm just so grateful that I woke up and decided not to drink. I had a year being a dry drunk. I don't recommend it. It's awful and terrible. I can't tell you how many times I got kicked off Facebook and Twitter for my amazing political opinions. Awful. They let me back on. But anyway, after a year that, I just got so sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, it was just that much for me. And I walked myself down to the anchor of Hull. Why was I walking? Because I had led a small, small life. I opted out of driving because I heard you guys got DUIs. Well, I was smarter than you, so I'm not going to drive. You know, like, these are the crazy decisions I would make in my head to rationalize and justify my drinking. So anyway, I walked down to the anchor of Hull. I remember what I was wearing. I remember what the beach smelled like, and the sand and the salt coming in my face. And, you know, I sat down in a chair just like one of these, and I just feel this rush of relief over me. And I stopped doing the judging, and I stopped. I put everything aside, and I knew that I belonged, and I knew I was right where I should be. So today, I hang on to my seat. I woke up this morning without the desire to drink, and when I was a little girl, I heard about miracles in places like Lourdes and Magicoria and all this kind of nice stuff, but they happen in places like Hull and Boston, too, and I'm just so grateful that I don't have the desire to drink, and I build my days around service and a meeting. So today, I get to be of service to my family, to my community, to my church, to AA, to the fellowship, to my district, to my area. So I say yes to recovery. I say yes to life, and life is just so much better. There is a solution in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's in the big book. So anyway, thanks for having me.
We will now observe the seventh tradition. AA has no dues or fees for AA membership, but we do have expenses. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group expenses, the seventh tradition is essentially at every level of AA service. Since the start of COVID-19 pandemic, GSO has withdrawn approximately $4.5 million from their reserve fund. AA's usual suggestion is a $2 contribution per meeting. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There is a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is at beacon-group. Again, although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, basket and our Venmo handle, we do have expenses. Our rent is $400 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Megan, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Mike has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
I'm Mike, I'm an addict.
Hey, Mike.
The 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Autonomy is the spiritual foundation of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you. Beacon Group is run by a business. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting, which meets on the third Wednesday of each month at 6:30 p.m. Eastern in a hybrid format, both here at St. Paul's Church and online. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? And now let us welcome for our second 10-minute speaker, Socrates.
Socrates, alcoholic. I'm really nervous, so I appreciate you all bearing with me on this. This isn't my first time through the halls, but we'll get there. This is my home group. I got sober November 21st of last year. I have a sponsor who knows that he's my sponsor. And I'm going to try and talk really quickly so that I can get through enough things here. So let's see how it goes. I had a really good childhood. I have nothing to blame in my, you know, youth for my alcoholism. My parents did the best that they could. They loved me. It was, you know, at times emotional and volatile. We definitely did a lot of yelling. It's a Greek household. But there's nothing really to blame there. In terms of why I am, I guess a lot to blame in terms of why I am the way I am, but I, you know, those were choices that I made later. Anyway, my childhood was good, you know, middle school was good, high school was fine. I got into a really good school, I worked really hard to get into that school, and I thought that, you know, once I finally got there, that all of the hard work would pay off. In some ways it did. You know, I didn't have all the structure that I had before. I was free to do what I wanted, and what I wanted turned out to be drinking and using substances a lot, and it did not work at all. And I very, very quickly became very deeply depressed. My expectations for what I was hoping college to be and what it actually turned out to be were pretty different, and so began this laundry cycle for me where I would get very, very, you know, upset, you know, at times suicidal and depressed. I would clean myself up, I would leave the school, go home, I would do therapy, I would hang out with my cats, I would work a job, I would do all of the things that I'm supposed to be doing except AA, coincidentally. And then I would go back to school. I'd write this essay, too, where I would say, you know, how everything was going to be different this time. And I would go back to school and fall right back on my face. And then I would get depressed, and then I would pick myself up, go home, do all the things again, take another year, go back, and over and over and over. It very much did not work. Eventually, I was faced with an ultimatum that I needed to either, you know, do something different or figure it out on my own. I was given that ultimatum by my mother, and you know, God bless her. I really appreciate that she, you know, finally gave me that opportunity to take things a little more seriously. I moved to Boston in 2017. I did a diagnostic program at McLean, and they figured out a lot of the things that I already knew, that I was very, very depressed. I had some, you know, anxiety issues and some other problems, and I did a whole bunch of therapy for that. Sobriety was a condition of my being at the program there, and so I moved into a sober house. As a part of being in that sober house, I had to go to meetings, and I begrudgingly went to meetings for a while. I wasn't really getting what I needed from them. I wasn't there really for the right reasons. I showed up to meetings because I thought that that's what I was supposed to do, and I was kind of checking off the boxes. Eventually, I changed sober houses, got my first sponsor, did kind of a ramshackle run through the steps, was really proud of the fact that I had done the steps in parts in name only. We skipped through We Agnostics. I found a sponsor that didn't believe in God, that didn't really feel as though it was too important for us to do every element of the steps as they were lined out. And you know, I kind of got what I paid for there. Thanks. And so, you know, like, my life got better. I got a job and a better job and an even better job, a girlfriend and a nicer, less angry girlfriend, a nice new apartment. I had cats. I had like all of the things that I wanted, and I still really wasn't happy. It never really was enough. I started to drift away from meetings. You know, I kind of had gotten what I thought I needed from them. And for a little while, I sort of white-knuckled my sobriety in the same way that I had, white-knuckled my way through a lot of life before that. And things were, like, mostly okay. It was one of those okays where you're, like, assuring everyone that everything's okay and really saying it a lot and often and hoping that that made it somehow more okay. And eventually life lifed. My grandfather passed. It was the first death that I'd ever really experienced. And it threw me for a pretty heavy loop. And when I got back from the funeral and wake, I felt like I really deserved to drink. There was no convincing me of anything otherwise. I really had whittled away at my, you know, program in sobriety before that. I'd kind of like stopped going to meetings. I didn't really need AA. I didn't need people in my life that could like tell me when things were right or wrong. I didn't need too many, you know, friends. I was just like good on my own with my cats and my girlfriend and my jobs and my cute little apartment. It was a really cute apartment, for the record. I relapsed, and I relapsed really, really, really hard. I went out, blacked out a few times, came home like belligerent, like things were just not great. And I lost a lot of those things. You know, I lost the girlfriend, I lost the apartment. I don't get to hang out with my cats as often as I would like to, which is ever really. And I honestly, I'm at this point really grateful for those things, because I think I needed to lose all of that to really take this thing seriously. And so this time through, I found a sponsor that had what I wanted, that I look up to, that seems to really be doing the work. I went to a meeting every day, sometimes two meetings a day. I got service positions in like almost every meeting I went to. I have more than one home group. Don't tell anyone though. It's, you know, it's our little secret. And I tried as much as I could to chase my sobriety as hard as I chased hiding from life in drinking and drugs. And so far that's been really effective. I now have people in my life that I care about. I've had this weird experience that keeps happening recently where people will tell me that they love me, and then I'm like, oh, you meet? And I kind of look like it's like a nice feeling to have people that care about you. And that's been really, really rewarding. I get advice from people that isn't what I want to hear, which is really nice. And my life is just like overall better than it was. It's fuller. And I feel weird when I don't go to meetings now. I never really enjoyed the God side of things. And now I pray every day, many times a day sometimes. And, you know, it's one of those things for me where I don't really understand why it works, but it does. I feel better. It's maybe like a selfish approach to God, but it seems to work, and I seem to be a better person when I regularly do these things, and so I kind of hope to keep doing them. And I really tried throughout my life to find any other way to get sober. If there were some magical system, you know, I would have found it. If it was just like doing enough yoga, like I would have done all of the yoga to stay sober. I tried that for a while and it really wasn't enough. And so I'm happy that I finally have something that works. And I'm really, really grateful that I have, you know, an opportunity to continue to build that contact with my higher power and continue to nurture the relationships in my life that are healthy for me, and continue to keep coming to meetings. So thank you guys.
We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our job coordinator.
Romero.
Sorry, I should name out. It's kind of hard not to on this. See Romero. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Jenny.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Jenny, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Jenny.
I'm not quite as tall as Socrates, despite what I want you to think. I just can't make you think I'm taller than I am. So anyway, I thank you for having me. Thank you to Amanda, wherever you are, for asking me to speak. And thanks for having me back. I've actually spoken here before, twice, so it's nice to be asked back. I really appreciate that. And it was a real treat to walk in here and see friends, you know, people that I know, even though I don't go to meetings nearby here anymore. It's nice, and I'm grateful that I get to know people in Alcoholics Anonymous in different parts of town. So I time myself, even though I do know that we have a timer here, but it's for everybody's safety, to keep me on track. So I was taught to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm using only my own experience, strength, and hope to share with you that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. Warn you right now, I get teared up a lot when I talk about AA. But it wasn't always like that. I was familiar with AA before I got here, and I freaking hated everything about it, you know? But that's not the way it is today. So, like other people shared about, thank you to the two 10-minute speakers. I really appreciated hearing you both. I grew up in a good home with parents who loved me and did their very best. In fact, they both were from very poor families. I think they were both the first to go to college in their families, and so they were very committed to giving their kids a much better life than the one that they grew up with. And I believe that they were successful with that. Having said that, because they both grew up with the family disease of alcoholism, and with no recovery, they also passed that along in the family as well. And I do, that's really important for me, and I do go to another 12-step program to recover from the family disease of alcoholism. And I, as mentioned before, it's not about blaming, it's about helping to understand the way that I function, and it helps me in my recovery. So I grew up with the fighting, the screaming, the yelling, and the silent treatment too. You know, it's like this combo, and a lot of drinking, you know. On the other hand, my mother's father was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so my first memories of AA were my mother telling me about how in the old days it was the best part of her childhood when her father had gotten sober, and they would sit around the coffee table and the kitchen table and have coffee, and the guys would come over and this and that, and it was really precious part of her childhood, remembering that. But having said that, nobody in my family had any interest in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And so I have lots of examples about what drinking looked like when it went awry, you know. And so it never occurred to me to not drink. My case was different. I was going to manage it. So from a very young age, and I mean really young, I was always thinking about how I was going to drink and how it was going to be. You know, most people say that they didn't, plan to be an alcoholic, you know. Well, I didn't plan to be an alcoholic in recovery, but I had always intended to be a dramatic drinker. You know, there's no question about that. And so I started drinking, you know, my first real drunk. I don't know when I started drinking, but my first real drunk was, just heard my voice get a little bit louder as I move this. You know, my friends and I went down to the refrigerator and we poured 3 big glasses of Manischewitz wine. And these were McDonald's glasses. You know, in the 70s, they had like the, you know, McDonald's, you know, Ronald McDonald or the burglar or whatever they were on it. And it was very classy. I always wanted to be classy. And I drank all mine, and then I drank all hers, and I drank all hers, and I threw up all night. And the next morning, fifth grade, I was like, I'm never drinking Manischewitz wine ever again, you know? And I kept to that. I did, you know? And so, you know, then I moved away from alcohol because for some reason it didn't seem cool, and I started getting into other mind-altering substances. But then I returned to alcohol in ninth grade because now I was mature, you know? And that next big drunk was Southern Comfort, you know? And this time it was in a crystal glass with ice. You know, and I drank all night, and then I threw up all night, and the next morning I said, I am never drinking Southern Comfort ever again, and I never did. And thus started my career of trying to control and enjoy my drinking. You know, my closest girlfriend was also my drinking partner. By the time I was in eighth grade, it was a regular thing, you know, that we were partying and drinking, and she drank like I did, and she got in trouble in high school. I mean, we both were in trouble all the time, but she got in such trouble that she had to read these 20 so-called questions of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had a list of 20 things I couldn't do, because if you did those, then you were an alcoholic, and then you had to stop drinking. I don't know where that math equation came from, but I thought it was all true. So I was very conscientious to never drink alone. If I was alone in my apartment and I was drinking and I called somebody on the phone, I was not alone, right? And, you know, if I called in sick to work because I was sick and hungover or I had not been to bed yet, and they believed me that I had the flu or something like that, then I wasn't missing work due to drinking. And on it goes, you know? So this is the type of behavior that I had, you know? I barely made it out of high school. I fell out of high school. I was not college bound, I can assure you. And, you know, I got a job answering phones at some office, you know? And I dressed not unlike tonight. I wore all prissy white clothing. And nobody swore around me at work, you know, because they all were like, they thought I was a real prude, uptight type person. That was the persona I wanted them to think. So that at night, when I was at the clubs and the bars, they would have no idea that if I needed to call in sick, they would believe me that I was, you know, I was truly sick. So it was all these machinations I had going on, you know. So as you can imagine, no wonder I didn't go to college. I was very busy, you know, I had a lot to do. And, you know, trying to manage and control my drinking. You know, and so, you know, in retrospect, you know, it's easy to wonder, like, why does a kid start drinking in fifth grade? You know, why does a kid put all their effort into that. You know, athletics never had any interest in that. School never had any interest in it. And they told me, Jenny, you're so bright if you would just apply yourself. I didn't know what that meant. But in retrospect, I now know that alcohol and drinking was the one thing that gave me a sense of well-being. And so, of course, I went after that. I didn't know what it meant to apply myself, but now I know I applied myself to drinking and getting away with it, you know? But I didn't know what it meant to, like, I didn't, you know, discipline was like a four-letter word. I wanted nothing to do with that, you know? So my life was going nowhere. And I had the, you know, unlike our friend who just shared, you know, I was going to funerals on a regular basis. You know, when you live the way I did in, you know, Los Angeles in the 80s, there's a lot of trouble happening for a drinker like me, you know? And the fact that I'm alive at all is a miracle and luck, just a lot of luck, you know? There were times when my drinking meant for me, you know, that I had to make a decision between staying in the car as the, in the passenger seat or jumping out of the moving car. You know, it was like, you know, like those were the places I put myself in, you know? You know, pretending like everything was okay. How am I going to get out of this one? How am I going to get out of this one? And then the next day, swearing, I'm never going to do that again. It's never going to happen again. And I believe all of us alcoholics, just from listening to people share about this over the year, have a list of things they swear they'll never do. It's different, I believe, for all of us. Some people could be jails, institutions, DUIs, whatever it is. But I had a list that I just slowly kept knocking off, you know, like, that wasn't that big of a deal. Why did I make such a big deal about that? You know? And so that was how I was living my life. I was in my early 20s, a kid who had promise. You know, I was going nowhere. And then, you know, what seemed like the worst day of my life is when my drinking partner and best girlfriend went to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I thought, oh my God, my life is over, because I felt like, you know, that TV show where they have the sands of time, you know, and then, you know, that turns it over, and I thought, like, this time thing was on me now to prove for real I wasn't an alcoholic, because then I was going to have to go to those meetings, you know? And not only did I know everything that there was to know about Alcoholics Anonymous without ever having stepped in the doors or read the literature, you know how they describe that, contempt prior to investigation? I liked contempt prior to investigation because I thought that made me look smart. And because I didn't go to school and I didn't go to college, I had to use techniques like that to make you think I was smart. So contempt prior to investigation was one of my specialties. So, you know, not only did I hate everything about it because, you know, people had to go places regularly, they had to show up, they were, you know, it was totally obviously a religious cult type thing, there was God, and all that type of stuff. And, of course, the worst part of all, people weren't drinking. So I wanted nothing to do with it, and I was willing to go to any length, you know? And so those last 9 months of my drinking were an absolute nightmare, you know, for me, you know, because it was the bouncing back and forth between really troubled drinking and getting very, very ill from my drinking, and then not drinking for 30 days to prove that I wasn't an alcoholic. And I think most alcoholics know there's only one way to celebrate that you're not an alcoholic, and that's by drinking, you know. And so, as was mentioned, it is a progressive illness I discovered that year. And, you know, I always prided myself on being able to drink with the guys and drinking guys under the table, because I didn't have any of those other, like, achievements in the world. That's something that I really prided myself on. And my tolerance for drinking, for alcohol, was going down really low that year. It was really excruciatingly embarrassing, and I found myself doing things I swore I would never do, and that list was getting more and more scratched off of the things I swore I would never do, you know? And that, and 3 months before I got sober, my former boyfriend, who I dated off and on for 10 years, was murdered. Now, I had had a lot of boyfriends who were dead from drugs and alcohol. But this was the first one that was murdered in a drugs and alcohol related situation. And that was the first time I experienced true heartbreak. But I also found a perfect excuse to drink, and nobody could tell me that I didn't deserve that. As my friend shared earlier, you know, I held those both concurrently with total grief and despair. And I can drink as I want now, you know? So those last 3 months of my drinking, the decline started to get really sharp, you know? And again, doing all the things I swore I'd never do. And I had a very ulcerated esophagus, which I now know is a very dangerous place to be in, you know? And Jack Daniels takes care of that. It really does. Until it doesn't, you know what I mean? And so, you know, the last night of my drinking, I did a series of things I swore I would never do, and I woke up in the morning. It was the morning, and certainly never went to bed, and the sun was coming up. It was a beautiful day in Los Angeles where I lived, and I was pouring wine into one of those large glasses, not unlike the McDonald's glasses of 1975, pouring wine from a jug, you know, the crappy white wine from the market, you know, because that's what I had on hand, you know. And I remember the sunlight and looking at the person that I had dragged home from the bar because I had totaled my car, so I needed a ride home. And this person looking at me with pity. This guy looking at me, feeling really sorry for me and worried about me. And I'm like, I'm totally fine. What's the problem, you know? And I had, that wasn't what got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was that my body was drunk and I could hear my mouth was saying words that were drunk. And I felt sober here, you know, meaning clear. I didn't feel drunk. And that scared me more than anything. A lot of people don't experience that, but now and again I hear people share about that. And it scared the hell out of me. I don't know if that word qualifies as profanity. If it does, I apologize. I've done well so far. I called my mom, I was an adult living in my own apartment. I had a total car and I panicked. And I asked my mother if I could go to her house. I said I had the flu. Back in those days, you could use that word, the flu. The flu doesn't fly anymore, you know? It's a big deal, the flu. But back then, you could have a flu, right? And so I said I had the flu, and she brought me into her apartment. Now, then she came home from work the next day, that day. I don't remember what it was. And she said, Jenny, I think there's something you may want to watch on television. And it was on a little crappy black and white TV. And it was... after TV movie, after school TV show called Sarah T, Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic. And if you guys don't think that I was horrified beyond belief, you know, they crushed. Like, here I was, I thought I was so hip. You know, I was always in West Hollywood in all the coolest clothes, getting kicked out of them, by the way, and all that. And here I was, you know, it all came down to this. Linda Blair, Sarah T, Portrait of an Alcoholic, you know? And because I had nothing better to do, I watched it. And I hate to give away the end, but she does go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she goes in and out of it, you know, but then finally she surrenders and all this type of stuff. And I mean, it's as corny as you can get. And you know what happened? I don't know. A freaking miracle happened. Because I called my closest girlfriend and asked her if she would take me to a meeting. And so that Saturday night, I went to my first meeting in North Hollywood, California. And, you know, they said, is anybody new here tonight who'd like to identify themselves? And I'm way in the back, 250-person meeting. And I get the elbow in the side, and I stood up for the first time and said, my name's Jennifer, and I'm an alcoholic. And my life changed dramatically at that moment. Lots of people admit that they're alcoholics long before they get sober. That wasn't the case for me, because I thought he had to stop drinking when you said you were an alcoholic. So I was going to say anything other than that. But when I did that, I always say that I feel like this huge, you know, 500-pound weight I had been carrying with me everywhere, every day, all the time, I let go of. I now think it was because it was the first time I was honest with myself and another human being, you know, in a long time, maybe since childhood, you know. And so I don't know what happened that night, you know, but everything changed. You know, they talk about the new pair of glasses. It was like everything was different. And I wanted what you had, you know, so they said, just do what we do, you know. And I got very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous right away, you know, and like other people shared, I looked around, I saw people I respected. My current sponsor was at that meeting that night, And I said, if you want what we have, do what we do. I said, fine. You know, like, I didn't have anything better to do, you know. So I went to a meeting every day. Well, at first I was like, 90 meetings in 90, don't you? They're like, just do it, you know. And so I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I got jobs at all the meetings that I went to. I got as involved as I could. I was taught to go to the meeting before it starts and leave after it's over. You know, half measures was kind of my middle name before that. And ultimately what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was to apply myself to my life, you know, whatever it was, you know. And at first I learned by applying myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I'm really incredibly grateful for the structure. You know, where I got sober, it's a very structured Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'm grateful for meetings like this that are very similar to the ones that I went to when I got sober. I went to discussion meetings also, and I think that they have a place. But it's in meetings like this that I learned how to listen. I don't know about you, but I didn't have any listening skills before I got sober, because I was always thinking about what was the next thing I was going to say to get out of something, or to get away with something, or made you think something, or whatever. So listening was not a part of the, you know, just didn't have any place in it, you know. And through the listening, I identified. And when I identify, recovery begins, you know. Recovery begins with one drunk talking to another, you know. And that's why, to me, the speaker meetings are very powerful, very important part of my recovery in Los Angeles, where I got sober, you know. And so I asked the first woman that I wanted what she had, I asked her to be my sponsor, because she was tall, for starters, and I loved that. I wanted to be tall, and she had beautiful nails and great jewelry, you know? I wanted what she had, okay? So, of course, she was never available when I called her, which was perfect for me, because I didn't really want to do, you know what I mean? So when I had 4 months sober, I asked myself, you know, was I going to play AA the way I played everything else? Or was I here for real, you know? And because this was about making you think I was a good little AA to begin with, you know? So then I asked my current sponsor today to be my sponsor, and she's been my sponsor most of my recovery since then. When I moved to Boston, when I had 6.5 years of sobriety, we did not have cell phones. And so at that time, you know, I had to get a local sponsor, and I was going to meetings here in Brookline. And I'm very grateful for the time that I spent here. And I'm very grateful that my current sponsor was willing to take me back. And she never, you know, I was always connected with her the whole time. So in any event, you know, I think it's very important to talk about what it was like, because I feel that the solution in the recovery doesn't really matter if you don't identify with the alcoholism. And hopefully if you don't identify with the facts, maybe the feelings, you know, of my story, you know. The despair, and then the, oh my God, really? There's another opportunity, I have another chance. I have a chance here, you know? And so what I learned in that first year, what I learned in the groups, I was able to take out into the rest of the world. I became a really good employee. I was able to go back to school, local community college, and then I eventually went to a university, and then I was able to go to graduate school, and that's how I ended up in Boston. And I just use all the tools I learned here. You know, show up on time, do what's asked of me, assist the folks next to me on either side, sit in the front if possible, you know, and all those types of things. Ask for help, be of service. All the tools I learned in that first year, I was able to apply to my life, and that's how I have a great life today. You know, my sobriety date is Friday the 13th. I got sober Friday the 13th, so it's always been a favorite day of mine ever since. January 13th, 1989. So it's not possible, even a little bit, to cover all of that in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or 30 minutes, right? The important part of my story is to share with you that, you know, the solution works. And I think, you know, the solution as it was presented to me may be slightly different from the one that you hear or need. I don't think there's any need to change this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous or the program, but it's really important for me to do, you know, to find people that I want what they have and then do it the way that they're doing it. You know, and that's one of the reasons that I will say to you that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are life-changing and have changed my life and continue to do so today. But I don't think it's important to talk about the specifics of those from the podium, because it's more important for me to say that find somebody who you want what they have and do it the way that they do it, and not the other way around. I often hear people say, well, I'd like you to be my sponsor, but I don't want to do the steps that way. You know what it's like? No, no. If you want what I have, you're going to do it the way I do it. And that's okay if you don't want what I have. Totally get that, and thank God, right? You know? But in any event, that's the reason why I don't think it's helpful to talk about the steps in any great detail from the podium. I think what's important for me to share about as far as what it's like today is to share with you that the framework that I learned, the structure of, you know, good AA habits that I learned in that first year are still with me today, and I've never lost them. I think it's very difficult for people who stop going to meetings for a while and try to come back and get back into it. And I don't mean that from a place, I mean it from a place of, I think it really is hard for people. It's like, you know, not putting my hand on the hot flame, you know. I haven't tried that, and I hope I never do, you know. I've always had regular meetings on regular meeting days. I get to them on time, and I leave after they're over. I have jobs at regular at my meetings. I do service, and I do service beyond the group level now, you know, and I've done that off and on for many years. In fact, that's the last few things that I wanted to share with you tonight about. For me, you know, I think that, you know, I've changed a lot over the last 34 years, thank God, right? You know, but the program and its general structure has not, you know? And there was an event that happened to me when I had about 9 months sober, and some people talk about, you know, coming off the pink cloud, you know, and things got rather dull. And I remember I was sitting in a meeting in the front row, and it was a big book meeting, and I shared that I was feeling a little bored in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And some old-timer came up to me after the meeting and gave me some unsolicited advice. And she said, "Sweetheart, if you're bored, it's because you're boring." And I, you know, my head almost exploded. I was like, I never forgot about that. You know, I never forgot about that, you know, because I was sitting around waiting for you to entertain me, right? You know, the first 9 months were pretty entertaining because not getting, you know, not being sick and not getting myself in more trouble from drinking, that was pretty fun those first 9 months. But after that kind of gets, you know, you're used to it. I was waiting for, you know, the dancing girls or whatever was supposed to happen, you know, and I was like, I'm bored, you know. And so that has been a real instigator through all my recoveries that, thank you, I'm in charge of how much I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And there have been times when I've been like painfully frustrated. You know, it's really hard moving across country and going to a new group of people that, you know, whether you say it out loud or not, you think they don't do it right, you know what I mean? And there's nothing more unpleasant than somebody who comes to a meeting and says, you guys aren't doing it right, you know what I mean? So I wasn't gonna say it, but I felt it and I thought it, you know? But once I made the decision that I was staying in the greater Boston area, actually I was in Cambridge, I had to make the decision to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous where I lived. It could be life or death, you know, and so that's where my story is now. It's falling in love with AA wherever I am, and that begins with me. I am responsible for that, not you guys, you know? So the last thing I'll share about is that, you know, as you guys know, there's three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous: unity, recovery, and service, you know? And all of those are equally important to me, but the things I want to share about each of those I've mentioned before about recoveries and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it's very important to find somebody who you want what they have and do it the way that they do that. I already shared that. For me, service, you know, my sponsor, when I was about 5 years sober, I asked my sponsor how come secretly, quietly, as though I thought somebody was going to overhear me, I said, how come nobody asked me to sponsor them, you know? And she said, sweetheart, there's different types of service for different types of people for different times in their recovery. And she said, you answer phones every other Saturday morning for 4 hours at Central Service, and you've been doing that for 5 years, 4 years at the time. She said, some people may never even step inside of the Central Service. Just, you know, whatever it is, just be of service wherever you are and do that. And that has been my case, you know. And then when I moved here, I couldn't even find Central Service. And then all of a sudden, all these women started asking me to sponsor them, you know what I mean? And so I take it as I go. And right now I'm really, you know, I've got some friends here who are several people here that are in area service. Do you guys even know that there's an area? You may not. It doesn't matter. the Alcoholics Anonymous is right here in this room, and that's all that matters. But it's been a great way for me to keep my recovery alive and to make sure that it's alive for people in the years to come. And the last thing I'll share about is I am really thinking a lot about these days, meditating on the legacy of unity. You know, I did a 12 traditions workshop in 2022 once a month. Once a month we went in through a different tradition and spent a lot of time in the traditions. And in step 12, or tradition 12, researching a lot of what our co-founders felt about it. And it all came back to unity, you know? And so for me, where I'm practicing that today is recognizing that it's trying to say that I don't belong to the best group in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is just for me, that I belong to the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and trying to resist language that is exclusionary or isolates me or separates me from you. And that's a hard shift. You know, I think a lot of us are taught this is the best group in AA. And this is the best group in AA, right? And wherever I am, that's the best group in AA, you know? But I think it's really important to really think about how can I contribute to the feeling of unity in Alcoholics Anonymous, to the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, rather than, you know, what I'm getting out of it or what I think is the way that it should be. So, again, I want to thank you. I want to thank my friend Brendan for coming with me tonight. It was a real treat for us to get to talk on the way here and back. And thank you all for having me and letting me share tonight.
Thank you. Now we have Chris.